Missiles and a Black Northern Night.
You're sure they're today's? Dad asked. We were just coming out of Kapuskasing and turning onto Highway 11, heading for Hearst, an hour's drive to the west. Newly arrived, I replied, flipping the Globe and Mail over to verify. Yep, Monday, October 22nd, 1962, and that would be today. What's left of it? I looked at him. Wonder if we'll have a tomorrow. He frowned but said nothing. If he'd put a radio in the car, we wouldn't be relying on outdated newspaper reports, and I wouldn't have had to spend my whole evening waiting for papers to come in on the late-night bus and cab. It occurred to me that now was a good time to renew the radio subject, but with the ominous events eddying about on the world stage, I didn't have the stomach. I felt cheated, blindsided by this whole Cuban Missile thing. I'd been fixated so long on my own problems, loneliness, how to overcome the growing gulf between me and my friends, how to break the news to my parents that I wouldn't be taking over the family business, that I hadn't seen the threat. Now my life, maybe our whole way of life, was hanging in the balance. The turbulent waters of the Kapuskasing River glared up at us as we crossed the bridge just below the dam. In the ambient light, foamy ice cream islands swirled in the whirlpools before disappearing down black holes. If our Oldsmobile had been a horse, it would have known the way home. Dad made this trip the first Monday of every month, and if his lodge brothers from Hearst were unavailable, I would go along for company. It was a trip I usually treasured, a chance to be alone with my father. Tonight, fellow members had chosen to stay home, ears glued to the radio. As a 22-year-old with my future in the hands of Kennedy and Khrushchev, that was where my heart was, too. "How was your meeting?" I asked, out of politeness. "Never mind that. You read the papers. I'll listen." "What time is it, Dad?"
1 minute to midnight," he said, without looking at his watch. I nodded casually before catching the significance of the hour. For a second I studied his profile, wondering if it really was 11:59, or whether he was editorializing on the Times. I'd been so concerned for my own future it hadn't occurred to me how terrifying the Cuban Missile Crisis must be for parents everywhere, but especially for those who had already lost a son to war and had another of conscriptable age. I had been a baby when my oldest brother had fallen at Dieppe in 1942, and although it had never been stated, I was the replacement my parents were pinning their hopes on. Now, 20 years after his death, madness had returned and the world was on the brink again. I stared into the darkness as I checked off the familiar landmarks that accompanied departure from Kapuskasing. The Tudor-styled inn across the river, the two bridges, the monument to the dead German prisoners from the First World War, the Catholic cemetery, the airport with its mesmerizing searchlight that played peekaboo with vehicles on the highway. Out of habit, I sought out its beam and began counting aloud the seconds it took to complete its arc and explode onto the windshield. Dad joined in, a nocturnal ritual we'd been playing out on this drive for as long as I could remember. 10. 9. Do you think they're stupid enough to do it, Dad?
I don't know, son. It's not looking good.
6. 5. Bertrand Russell thinks the Americans have no justification for denying the Russians the same rights in Cuba that they've claimed in Turkey.
4. 3.
I know, Raymond, but the states will never allow the Russians to put atomic weapons in Cuba or anywhere else in the American hemisphere. It's the big stick policy all over again.
2. 1.
Who's talking sticks? They've progressed to hydrogen bombs.
0.
A blinding light shimmered across the windshield. Our arms shot up to block the glare. Then it was gone, and we plunged back into the blackness of Highway 11. Ordinarily, at this point, Dad would be crooning something ridiculous like,
"Arrivederci, Kapuskasing,"
but it didn't seem appropriate tonight. After a few minutes, he glanced at the paper in my hands, anxious for me to get on with the reading. "Take your time," he said, reaching out to touch my arm. I switched on the overhead light, snapped open the globe, and cleared my throat. Under normal circumstances, I'd be turning to the sports page to see if the Stampeders were still burning up the Western Conference. But, like song, football had lost its glitter. I read mechanically, my voice adapting to the cadence of the car's engine, scarcely comprehending the magnitude of the words that crossed my lips. Washington. There's an air of crisis tonight as the armed forces of the United States stage a powerful show off Cuba. President Kennedy says the Soviets are turning Castro's island into a base capable of raining nuclear destruction on America.
Russian missile silos have already been constructed, and the warheads to arm them are at this moment on the high Atlantic, steaming their way to Cuba.
Goodness, Dad said.
Next, I glanced at the front page of the Toronto Star. They're quoting the New York Times, I said, beginning to read again. Tonight the president has drawn a line in the sand. Soviet ships that refuse to turn back or submit to search will be attacked by the U.S. Navy, effective 10 a.m. Wednesday. This also applies to planes. And if the Soviets try to retaliate with a counter-blockade of Berlin, the U.S. is prepared to risk total nuclear war.
What are the Russians saying? Dad asked.
Khrushchev refuses to submit to American threats. I turned off the light and looked out the window. Like a capsule in space, we sliced quietly through the night. It started to snow. Dad turned on the wipers, then dimmed the headlights to cut the hypnotic effect of the flakes swirling through the high beams. The engine heat found the passenger compartment. I removed my parka. Snow slapped rhythmically against the rocker panels beneath us. Dad slowed. I had my thoughts, he had his, but there was solidarity in our stillness. Our concern was for each other, our loved ones, and the country we held dear. I felt his presence, he felt mine. Whatever was out there, whatever lay ahead, would never erase this moment. Somewhere between Val Rita and Opus Attica, two eyes, wolf, lynx, fox, glared into our headlights, then darted through the ditch and off into the bush. Dad said nothing, nor did I, but as it disappeared, I wondered how it would fare in the conflagration to come. When Dad began to sing,
"Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm hath bound the restless wave,"
I found myself fighting the urge to join in. With the world about to implode and God sitting idle on the sidelines, religion was not high on my list. Oh, I still attended service, but it was more about pleasing the folks and fantasizing about the minister's wife than fulfilling any Christian yearnings. I sat determined not to sing, but with Dad's soothing baritone warming the darkness, I felt my resolve crumbling. Almost silently at first, then picking up volume, I joined in.
"A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing, protecting us with staff and rod, and power all prevailing. What if the nations rage, and surging seas rampage? What though the mountains fall? The Lord is God of all."
I sang with vigor to drown the revulsion swirling inside me. Revulsion for our American cousins, Christians all, who were dragging us into the vortex. Revulsion for a Russian government intent on exporting European-styled carnage to the Americas. Revulsion for the naivete of hymns that promised salvation but delivered Armageddon. Revulsion even for my father's fervent, innocent belief in the specious message of the hymns. Revulsion for the goosebumps forming on my body as I sang. Revulsion for all fraternities that bound men in senseless societies capable of perpetrating despicable acts. But I repressed these thoughts. Somehow this was my tribe, and this was our way. Without speaking, we worked our way through the old, familiar, bellicose hymns as if inducing God to our side. Onward, Christian soldiers, soldiers of Christ arise, faith of our fathers living still. Together, singing our way through the black night, we became one of the mighty army of the Church of God. Matthijs shocked me back to reality. The streets were empty, the houses dark. I blinked at the billowy clouds of snow that swirled off rooftops and danced through the lamplights like nebulous ghosts riding the wind. Were the four horsemen out tonight? A scene from On the Beach, a movie making the rounds, flitted through my mind. The story revolved around nuclear holocaust, with the whole world, except Australia, dead from radioactive fallout. But the Aussies are dying too, and in a scene that reoccurs throughout the movie, the Salvation Army plays on and on with dwindling numbers, until finally the instruments lie mute, the army brethren having fallen too. "And what do you plan to do?" Dad said. I picked at a hangnail, then absent-mindedly pressed in the cigarette lighter. "Join up, I guess. Isn't that what we Martins always do? Ask me again after 10 a.m. Wednesday if we're still alive." Dad shook his head.
I meant, what do you plan to do with your life, your future?
I pulled the lighter out. A red glow reflected off the dashboard and onto Dad's face, then faded.
What future would that be? I said, pointing to the newspaper on the seat beside us. The Chinese and Indians are at war in Tibet. The Flemish and Walloons are throwing Molotov cocktails at each other. The East Germans are killing their own in Berlin. Children the world over are drinking strontium-90 in their milk, and the Americans and Russians are preparing to annihilate civilization over Cuba.
Dad shook his head. Can't think that way, son. I'm 64 years old, and I've lived through the Boer War, 2 World Wars, and the Korean War. They were painful, but we muddled through. I'm telling you, the biggest danger is people giving up. You'll see. All this will come to pass.
For an instant, I thought he was going to break into another hymn. But instead, he flicked the light beam up and down to see if he could minimize the numbing effect of the incoming snow.
So, have you made a decision about taking over the family business?
I strained to see through the flakes slanting into the windshield and swallowed.
With my future destined to collide with damnation in the next 72 hours, how could my father pick this moment to bring up the topic I'd been avoiding for months? But in an uncommon moment of lucidity, I realized his initiative was double-pronged. He wanted me to think beyond the immediate abyss and at the same time come to a decision. A year earlier, he had made it plain that his business, the culmination of his life's work, plus a chance to play a role in the community we both loved, was available to me. But I, pampered son, university-educated at no expense or hardship to myself, after months of trial in the store, was leaning towards something more exciting than the hardware trade. At 22, single and still under the watchful eye of my folks, I pined for a larger stage. In the glossy print of the magazines that came into our apartment, I'd been watching the emancipation of the colonial world. Burundi, Algeria, and Uganda had just been added to Nigeria and the Belgian Congo as the latest to stake a claim in independence. They would be making their own way now. I longed to do the same. Visions of nuclear annihilation disappeared. "I'm going to join the diplomatic corps," I said, looking straight ahead into the dizzying snow. It was out. For months the folks had been nervously awaiting my decision, careful never to prod, but longing to know. From the corner of my eye I detected Dad's head nodding. I felt the blood returning to my fingers and toes.
"Your mother and I figured as much," he said.
"Guess the hardware business is out then, eh?"
"I'm sorry, Dad. I know you were hoping, but my heart's really in foreign affairs. Who knows? Maybe I can make a difference in this crazy world."
"No need for apologies, son. You have a dream. Follow it. This isn't like the old days when sons were expected to follow in their father's footsteps.
Your grandfather thought I'd be a farmer, but I surprised him by adding a year at business college to grade 8 and setting off to be a banker. And wound up in a store in Hearst," I said, immediately regretting the banality of my tone.
He shook his head. "Not just a store, a way of life, a good life."
I sunk into my seat, overwhelmed by the magnitude of the subject.
With the world about to end, this man, my father, was liberating me from any obligation to him or mother, and he was doing it with a gentleness and understanding that would take me decades to comprehend. Was he disappointed? Deeply. Was there bitterness or vindictiveness in his response? None that I could perceive or ever expected to feel. I fished for appropriate words, praying my voice would hold.
"I'm good with people," I said. "You and Mom taught me that. It's an important ingredient in diplomacy."
"You'll be wonderful at it, a credit to the family. Just remember, whatever you do, your mother and I will always be proud of you." That, I realized, was something I could build a future on.